The young woman stood on a corner in the shades. Her general stance indicated that she was, in the specialised patois of the area, a lady-in-waiting. To be more precise, a lady-in-waiting for Mr. Wright, or at least, Mr. Wright amount. She idly swung her hand back. This was a very recognisable signal for anyone with the brains of a pigeon. A member of the Thieves' Guild would have passed carefully by on the other side of the lane, giving her nothing more than a gentlemanly and above all non-aggressive nod. Even the less polite freelance thieves who lurked in this area would have thought twice before eyeing the handbag. The Seamstresses' Guild operated a very swift and non-reversible kind of justice. The skinny body of Dunnett Duncan, however, did not have the brains of a pigeon. The little man had been watching the bag like a cat for fully 5 minutes, and now the very thought of its contents had hypnotized him. He could practically taste the money. He rose on his toes, lowered his head, dashed out of the alley, grabbed the bag and got several inches before the world exploded behind him and he ended up flat in the mud. Something right by his ear started to drool, and there was a long, very long drawn-out growl, not changing in tone at all, just unrolling a deep promise of what would happen if he tried to move. He heard footsteps, and out of the corner of his eyes saw a swirl of lace.
"Oh, done it," said a voice. "Bag snatching, that's a bit low, isn't it, even for you? You could have got really hurt." "Oh, it's only Duncan, miss, he'll be no trouble, you can let him up."
The weight was removed from Duncan's back. He heard something pad off into the gloom of an alley.
I done it,
said the little thief desperately as Corporal Nobbs helped him to his feet.
"Yes, I know you did, I saw you," said Nobby. "And you know what would happen to you if the Thieves Guild spotted you? You'd be dead in the river with no time off for good behaviour."
"They hate me because I'm so good," said Duncan through his matted beard. "Here, you know that robbery at Old Jolson's last month? I done that."
"That's right, Duncan, you done that."
"And at all at the Gold Vaults last week? I done that too. It wasn't Coalface and his boys."
"No, it was you, wasn't it, Duncan?"
"And that job at the Goldsmiths that everyone says Crunchy Ron done?"
"You done that, did you?"
"That's right," said Duncan.
"And it was you what stole fire from the gods too, wasn't it, Duncan?"
said Nobby, grinning evilly under his wig.
"Yeah, that was me."
Duncan nodded. He sniffed.
"I was a bit younger then, of course."
He peered short-sightedly at Nobby Nobbs.
"Why have you got a dress on, Nobby?"
"It's us, Duncan."
"Ah, right."
Duncan shifted uneasily.
"You couldn't spare me a bob or two, could you, Nobby? I ain't eaten for 2 days."
Small coins gleamed in the dark.
"Now push off," said Corporal Nobbs.
"Thanks, Nobby. You got any unsolved crimes, you know where to find me."
Duncan lurched off into the night. Sergeant Angwer appeared behind Nobby, buckling on her breastplate.
"Poor old devil," she said.
"He was a good thief in his day,"
said Nobby, taking a notebook out of his handbag and jotting down a few lines.
"Kind of you to help him," said Angwer.
"Well, I can get the money back out of petty cash," said Nobby. "And now we know who did the bullying job, don't we? That'll be a feather in my cap with Mr. Vimes."
"Bonnet, Nobby."
"What?"
"Your bonnet, Nobby. It's got a rather fetching band of flowers around it."
"Oh, yeah."
"It's not that I'm complaining," said Angwer, "but when we were assigned to this job, I thought it was me who was going to be the decoy, and you who was going to be the backup, Nobby."
"Yeah, but what were you being..."
Nobby's expression creased as he edged his way into unfamiliar linguistic territory. "More for logically gifted?"
"A werewolf, Nobby. I know the word."
"Right, well, obviously you'd be a lot better at lurking, and obviously it's not right, women having to act as decoys in police work."
Angua hesitated, as she so often did when attempting to talk to Nobby on difficult matters, and waved her hands in front of her as if trying to shape the invisible dough of her thoughts.
"It's just that... I mean, people might..." she began. "I mean, well... you know what people call men who wear wigs and gowns, don't you?"
"Yes, miss."
"You do?"
"Yes, miss. Lawyers, miss."
"Good. Yes, good," said Angua slowly. Now try another one.
Actors, miss?
Angua gave up. You look good in taffeta, Nobby, she said.
You don't think it makes me look too fat?
Angua sniffed. Oh, no, she said quietly.
I thought I'd better put scent on for very silly mitude, said Nobby quickly.
What? Oh. Angua shook her head and took another breath. I can smell something else.
That's surprising, because this stuff's a bit on the pungent side, and frankly, I don't think Lily of the Valley is supposed to smell like this.
It's not perfume.
But the lavender stuff they had, you could clean brass with.
Can you get back to the chiselling station by yourself, Nobby? Said Angua. Despite her rising panic, she mentally added, After all, what could happen? I mean, really?
Yes, miss?
There's something I'd better sort out. Angua hurried away, the new scent filling her nostrils. It would have to be powerful to combat odour knobs, and it was. Oh, it was. Not here, she thought. Not now. Not him. The running man swung along a branch wet with snow and managed at last to lower himself onto a branch belonging to the next tree. That took him a long way from the stream. How good was their sense of smell? Pretty damn good, he knew, but this good? He'd got out of the stream onto another overhanging branch. If they'd followed the banks, and they'd be bright enough to do that, they'd surely never know he'd left the stream. There was a howl away to the left. He headed right, into the gloom of the forest. Vimes heard Carrot scrabble around in the gloom and the sound of a key in the lock.
I thought the Campaign for Equal Heights was running this place now, he said. It's so hard to find volunteers, said Carrot, ushering him through the low door and lighting a candle. I come in every day just to keep an eye on things, but no one else seems very interested.
I can't imagine why, said Vimes, looking around the Dwarf Bread Museum.
The one positive thing you could say about the bread products around him was that they were probably as edible now as they had been on the day they were baked. Forged was a better term. Dwarf bread was made as a meal of last resort and also as a weapon and a currency. Dwarfs were not, as far as Vimes knew, religious in any way, but the way they thought about bread came close. There was a tinkle and a scrabbling noise somewhere in the gloom.
Rats, said Carrot. They never stop trying to eat dwarf bread, poor things. Ah, here we are, the scone of stone. A replica, of course.
Vimes stared at the misshapen thing on its dusty display stand. It was vaguely scone-like, but only if someone pointed this out to you beforehand. Otherwise, the term, a lump of rock, was pretty accurate. It was about the size and shape of a well-sat-on cushion. There were a few fossilized currants visible.
My wife rests her feet on something like that when she's had a long day, he said.
It's 1,500 years old, said Carrot, with something like awe in his voice.
I thought this was a replica.
Well, yes, but it's a replica of a very important thing, sir, said Carrot.
Vimes sniffed. The air had a certain pungent quality.
Smells strongly of cats in here, doesn't it? I'm afraid they get in after the rats, sir. A rat who's nibbled on dwarf bread tends not to be able to run very fast.
Vimes lit a cigar. Carrot gave it a look of uncertain disapproval.
We do thank people for not smoking in here, sir, he said.
Why?
You don't know they're not going to, said Vimes.
He leaned against the display cabinet.
All right, Captain. Why am I really going to bonk? I don't know a lot about diplomacy, but I do know it's never just about one thing. What's the low, King? Why are our dwarfs scrapping?
Well, sir, have you heard of Kruk?
Dwarf mining law, said Vimes.
Well done, sir, but it's a lot more than that. It's about how you live. Laws of ownership, marriage laws, inheritance, rules for dealing with disputes of all kinds, that sort of thing. Everything, really. And the Low King, well, you could call him the final court of appeal. He's advised, of course, but he's got the last word. Still with me? Makes sense so far. And he is crowned on a scone of stone and sits on it to give his judgments because all the Low Kings have done that ever since Bahrain Blood Axe, 1500 years ago. It gives authority.
Vimes nodded dourly. That made sense, too. You did something because it had always been done, and the explanation was, but we've always done it this way. A million dead people can't have been wrong, can they?
Does he get elected or born or what? He said.
I suppose you could say he's elected, said Carrot. But really, a lot of senior dwarfs arrange it amongst themselves, after listening to other dwarfs, of course. Taking soundings, it's called. Traditionally, he's from one of the big families, but,
Yes?
Things are a little different this year. Tempers are a bit stretched.
Ah, thought Vimes.
Wrong dwarf won, he said.
Some dwarfs would say so, but it's more that the whole process has been called into question, said Carrot, by the dwarfs in the biggest dwarf city outside Uberwald.
Don't tell me. That must be that place hubwards of...
It's Ankh-Morpork, sir.
What? We're not a dwarf city?
50,000 dwarfs now, sir.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir.
Of course he is, Vimes thought. He probably knows them all by name.
You have to understand, sir, that there's a sort of big debate going on, said Carrot, on how you define a dwarf.
Well, some people might say they're called dwarfs because...
No, sir, not size. Nobby Nobs is shorter than many dwarfs, and we don't call him a dwarf.
We don't call him human either, said Vimes.
And, of course, I am also a dwarf.
You know, Carrot, I keep meaning to talk to you about that.
Adopted by dwarfs, brought up by dwarfs. To dwarfs, I'm a dwarf, sir. I can do the rite of Kazakra. I know the secrets of Haragna. I can halk my grakka correctly. I am a dwarf.
What do those things mean?
I'm not allowed to tell non-dwarfs. Carrot tactfully tried to stand out of the way of the cigar smoke. Unfortunately, some of the mountain dwarfs think that the dwarfs who moved away aren't proper dwarfs either. But this time, the kingship has been swung by the views of the Ankh-Morpork dwarfs, and a lot of dwarfs back home don't like it. There's been a lot of bad feeling all round. Families falling out, that sort of thing. Much pulling of beards.
Really?
Vimes tried not to smile.
It's not funny if you're a dwarf.
Sorry.
And I'm afraid this new Low King is only going to make matters worse, although, of course, I wish him well.
Tough, is he?
I think you can assume, sir, that any dwarf who rises sufficiently in dwarf society to even be considered as a candidate for the kingship did not get there by singing the hi-ho song and bandaging wounded animals in a forest. But by dwarf standards, King Rhys Reeson is a modern thinker, although I hear he doesn't like Ankh-Morpork very much.
Sounds like a very clear thinker, too.
Anyway, this has upset a lot of the more, traditional mountain dwarfs, who thought the next king would be Albrecht Albrechtsen.
Oh, he's not a modern thinker.
He thinks even coming up above ground is dangerously non-dwarfish.
Vimes sighed.
Well, I can see there's a problem, Carrot, but the thing about this problem, the key point, is it's not mine. Or yours, dwarf or not.
He tapped the scone's case.
Replica, eh?
He said.
Sure it's not the real one?
Sir, there is only one real scone. We call it the thing and the whole of the thing.
Well, if it's a good replica, who'd know?
Any dwarf would, sir.
Only joking.
There was a hamlet down there where two rivers met. There would be boats. This was working. The slopes behind him were white and free of dark shapes. No matter how good they were, let them try to outswim a boat. Hard-packed snow crunched under his feet. He staggered past the few rough hovels, saw the jetty, saw the boats, fought with the frozen rope that moored the nearest one, grabbed an oar, and pushed himself out into the current. There was still no movement on the hills. Now, at last, he could take stock. It was a bigger boat than one man could handle, but all he had to do was fend off the banks. That would do for tonight. In the morning he could leave it somewhere, and perhaps ask someone to get a message through to the tower. Then he'd buy a horse and... Behind him, under the tarpaulin in the bows, something started to growl.
They really were very clever.
In a castle not very far away, the vampire Lady Margalotta sat quietly leafing through Twerp's Peerage. It wasn't a very good reference book for the countries on this side of the Ramtops, where the standard work was the Almanach de Gothic, in which she herself occupied almost 4 pages. Vampires evolve long names, it's something to do to pass the long years. But if you needed to know who thought they were who in Ankh-Morpork, it was invaluable. Her copy was now bristling with bookmarks. She sighed and pushed it away. Beside her was a fluted glass containing a red liquid. She took a sip and made a face. Then she stared at the candlelight and tried to think like Lord Vetinari. How much did he suspect? How much news got back? The Clax Tower had only been up for about a month, and it was being roundly denounced throughout Bjonk as an intrusion. But it seemed to be doing a good, if stealthy, local traffic. Who would he send? His choice would tell her everything, she was sure. Someone like Lord Rust or Lord Salachi. Well, she'd think a lot less of him. From all that she had heard, and Lady Margalotta heard a lot of things, the Ankh-Morpork diplomatic corps as a whole could not find its backside with a map. Of course, it was good business for a diplomat to appear stupid, right up to the moment where he'd stolen your socks, but Lady Margalotta had met some of Ankh-Morpork's finest, and no one could act that well. The growing howling outside began to get on her nerves. She rang for her butler.
"Yes, mistress,"
said Igor, materializing out of the shadows.
"Go and tell the children of the night to make wonderful music somewhere else, will you? I have a headache."
"Indeed, mistress."
Lady Margalotta yawned. It had been a long night. She'd think better after a good day's sleep. As she went to blow out the candle, she glanced again at the book. There was a marker in the V's. But surely even the patrician couldn't know that much. She hesitated and then pulled the bell rope above the coffin. Igor reappeared, in the way of Igor's.
"Those keen young men at the Clax Tower will be awake, won't they?"
"Yes, mistress."
"Send a clax to our agent asking for everything about Commander Vimes of the Watch, will you?"
"Is he a diplomat, mistress?"
Lady Margalotta lay back.
"No, Igor. He's the reason for diplomats. Close the lid, will you?"
Sam Vimes could parallel process. Most husbands can. They learn to follow their own line of thought while, at the same time, listening to what their wives say. And the listening is important because at any time they could be challenged and must be ready to quote the last sentence in full. A vital additional skill is being able to scan the dialogue for telltale phrases such as, "And they can deliver it tomorrow," or, "So I've invited them for dinner," or, "They can do it in blue really quite cheaply." Lady Sybil was aware of this. Sam could coherently carry an entire conversation while thinking about something completely different.
"I'll tell Willikins to pack winter clothes," she said, watching him. "It'll be pretty cold up there at this time of year."
"Yeah, that's a good idea," Vimes continued to stare at a point just above the fireplace.
"We'll have to host a party ourselves, I expect, so we ought to take a cartload of typical Ankh-Morpork food. Show the flag, you know. Do you think I should take a cook along?"
"Yes, dear, that would be a good idea. No one outside the city knows how to make a knuckle sandwich properly."
Sybil was impressed. Ears operating entirely on automatic had nevertheless triggered the mouth into making a small but pertinent contribution. She said,
"Do you think we ought to take the alligator with us?"
"Yes, that might be advisable."
She watched his face. Small furrows formed on Vimes's brow as the ears nudged the brain. He blinked.
"What, alligator?"
"You are miles away, Sam. In Oberwald, I expect."
"Sorry."
"Is there a problem?"
"Why is he sending me, Sybil?"
"I'm sure Havelock shares with me a conviction that you have hidden depths, Sam."
Vimes sank gloomily into his armchair. It was, he felt, a persistent flaw in his wife's otherwise practical and sensible character,
that she believed, against all evidence, that he was a man of many talents. He knew he had hidden depths. There was nothing in them that he'd like to see float to the surface. They contained things that should be left to lie. There was also a nagging worry that he couldn't quite pin down. Had he been able to, he might have expressed it like this. Policemen didn't go on holiday. Where you got policemen, as Lord Vetinari was wont to remark, you got crime. So if he went to Pionk, however you pronounce the damn place, there would be a crime. It was something the world always laid on for policemen.
"It'll be nice to see Seraphine again," said Sybil.
"Yes, indeed," said Vimes. In Pionk he would not, officially, be a policeman. He did not like this at all. He liked this even less than all the other things. On the few occasions he'd been outside Ankh-Morpork and its surrounding fiefdom, he'd either been going to other local cities where the Ankh-Morpork badge carried some weight, or he had been in hot pursuit, that most ancient and honourable of police procedures. From the way Carrot talked, in Bionk his badge would merely figure as extra roughage on someone's menu. His brow wrinkled again.
"Seraphine?"
"Lady Seraphine von Uberwald," said Sybil. "Sergeant Angua's mother. You remember me telling you last year? We were at finishing school together. Of course, we all knew she was a werewolf, but nobody would ever dream of talking about that sort of thing in those days. Well, you just didn't. There was all that business over the ski instructor, of course, but I'm certain in my own mind that he must have fallen down some crevasse or other. She married the Baron, and they lived just outside Bionk. I'd write to her with a little news every hog's watch. A very old werewolf family."
"A good pedigree," said Vimes absently.
"You know you wouldn't like Angua to hear you say that, Sam. Don't worry so. You'll have a chance to relax, I'm sure. It'll be good for you."
"Yes, dear."
"It'll be like a second honeymoon," said Sybil.
"Yes, indeed," said Vimes, remembering that what with one thing and another, they'd never really had a first one.
"On that, subject," said Sybil, a little more hesitantly, "you remember I told you I was going to see old Mrs. Content?"
"Oh, yes. How is she?"
Vimes was staring at the fireplace again. It wasn't just old school friends. Sometimes it seemed Sybil kept in touch with anyone she'd ever met. Her Hogswatch card list ran to a second volume.
"Quite well, I believe. Anyway, she agrees that—"
There was knocking at the door. She sighed. "It's Willikin's evening off," she said. "You'd better answer it, Sam. I know you want to."
"I've told them not to disturb me unless it's serious," said Vimes, getting up.
"Yes, but you think all crime is serious, Sam."
Carrot was on the doorstep.
"It's a bit political, sir," he said.
"What's so political at 9:15 at night, Captain?"
"The Dwarf Bread Museum's been broken into, sir," said Carrot.
Vimes looked into Carrot's honest blue eyes.
"A thought occurs to me, Captain," he said slowly, "and the thought is a certain item has gone missing."
"That's right, sir."
"And it's the replica scone."
"Yes, sir.
Either they broke in just after we left, or—"
Carrot licked his lips nervously—
"they were hiding while we were there."
"Not rats, then?"
"No, sir. Sorry, sir."
Vimes fastened his cloak and took his helmet off its peg.
"So, someone has stolen a replica of the scone of stone a few weeks before the real one is due to be used in a very important ceremony," he said. "I find this intriguing."
"That's what I thought too, sir."
Vimes sighed. "I hate the political ones." When they'd gone, Lady Sybil sat for a while staring at her hands. Then she took a lamp into the library and pulled down a slim volume bound in white leather, on which had been embossed in gold the words, "Our Wedding." It had been a strange event. Ankh-Morpork's high society, so high that it's stinking, Sam always said, had turned up mostly out of curiosity. She was Ankh-Morpork's most eligible spinster, who'd never thought she'd be married. And he was a mere captain of the guard who tended to annoy a lot of people. And here were the iconographs of the event. There she was, looking rather more expansive than radiant, and there Sam was, scowling at the viewer with his hair hastily smoothed down.
There was Sergeant Colon, with his chest inflated so much his feet had almost left the ground, and Nobby grinning widely, or perhaps just making a face. It was so hard to tell with Nobby. Sybil turned over the pages with care. She had put a sheet of tissue between each one to protect them. In many ways, she told herself, she was very lucky. She was proud of Sam. He worked hard for a lot of people. He cared about people who weren't important. He always had far more to cope with than was good for him. He was the most civilized man she'd ever met. Not a gentleman, thank goodness, but a gentle man. She never really knew what it was he did. Oh, she knew what the job was, but by all accounts, he didn't spend much time behind his desk. When he eventually came to bed, he tended to drop his clothes straight into the laundry basket, so she'd only hear later from the laundry girl about the bloodstains and the mud. There were rumours of chases over rooftops, hand-to-hand and knee-to-groin fights with men who had names like Harry the Bolt-Cutter Weems. There was a Sam she knew, who went out and came home again, and there was another Sam Vimes, who hardly belonged to her, and lived in the same world as all those men with the dreadful names. Sybil Ramkin had been brought up to be thrifty, thoughtful, genteel in an outdoor sort of way, and to think kindly of people. She looked at the pictures again, in the silence of the house. Then she blew her nose loudly and went off to do the packing and other sensible things. Corporal Cheery Littlebottom pronounced her name Cherie. She was a she, and therefore a rare bloom in Ankh-Morpork. It wasn't that dwarfs weren't interested in sex. They saw the vital need for fresh dwarfs to leave their goods to and continue the mining work after they'd gone. It was simply that they also saw no point in distinguishing between the sexes anywhere but in private. There was no such thing as a dwarfish female pronoun, or, once the children were on solids, any such thing as women's work. Then Cheery Littlebottom had arrived in Ankh-Morpork and had seen that there were men out there who did not wear chain mail or leather underwear, at least of the sort she normally wore, but did wear interesting colours and exciting makeup. And these men were called women, and, just lately, Corporal Nobbs. And in the little bullet head the thought had arisen, why not me? Now she was being denounced in cellars and dwarf bars across the city as the first dwarf in Ankh-Morpork to wear a skirt. It was hard-wearing brown leather and as objectively erotic as a piece of wood, but, as some of the older dwarfs would point out, somewhere under there were his knees. They couldn't bring themselves to utter the word her. Worse, they were now finding that among their sons were some, they choked on the word, daughters. Cheery was only the frothy bit on the tip of the wave. Some younger dwarfs were shyly wearing eyeshadow and declaring that, as a matter of fact, they didn't like beer. A current was running through dwarf society. Dwarf society was not against a few well-thrown rocks in the direction of those bobbing on the current, but Captain Carrot had put the word on the street that this would be assault on an officer, a subject on which the watch held views, and however short the miscreants, their feet really would not touch the ground. Cheery had retained her beard and round iron helmet, of course. It was one thing to declare that you were female, but quite unthinkable to declare that you weren't a dwarf.
"Open and shut case, sir," she said when she saw Vimes come in. "They opened the window in the back room to get in, a very neat job, and didn't shut the front door after they left. Smashed the scones case. There's the glass all around the stand. Didn't take anything else that I can see. Left a lot of footprints in the dust. I took a few pictures, but they're scuffed up and weren't much good in the first place. That's about it, really."
"No dropped fag-ends, wallets, or bits of paper with an address on them," said Vimes.
"No, sir, they were inconsiderate thieves."
"They certainly were," said Carrot, grimly. "A question that springs to mind," said Vimes, "is, why does it reek even worse a cat's piss now?"
"It is rather sharp, isn't it?" said Cheery. "With a hint of sulphur, too. Constable Ping said it was like this when he arrived, but there's no cat prints." Vimes crouched down and looked at the broken glass. "How do we find out about this?" he said, prodding a few fragments. "Constable Ping heard the tinkle, sir. He went round the back and saw the window was open. Then the crooks got out through the front door."
"Sorry about that, sir," said Ping, stepping forward and saluting.
He was a cautious-looking young man who appeared permanently poised to answer a question. "We all make mistakes," said Vimes. "You heard glass break?"
"Yes, sir, and someone swore."
"Really? What did they say?"
Bugger, sir."
"And you went round the back and saw the broken window, and you—"
"I called out, 'Is there anyone there, sir?'"
"Really? And what would you have done if her voice had said no?" No, don't answer that. What happened next?"
I heard a lot more glass break, and when I got round to the front, the door was open and they were gone. So I legged it back to the yard and told Captain Carrot, sir, knowing he sets a lot of store by this place."
"Thank you. Ping, is it?"
"Yes, sir."
Entirely unasked, but obviously prepared to answer, Ping said,
"It's a dialect word, meaning water meadow, sir."
"Off you go, then." The Lance Constable visibly sagged with relief and left. Vimes let his mind unfocus a little. He enjoyed moments like these, the little bowl of time when the crime lay before him and he believed that the world was capable of being solved. This was the time you really looked to see what was there, and sometimes the things that weren't there were the most interesting things of all. The scone had been kept on a plinth about 3 feet high, inside a case made of 5 sheets of glass forming a box that was screwed down on the plinth. "They smashed the glass by accident," he said eventually.
"Really, sir?"
"Look here, see?" Vimes pointed to 3 loose screws neatly lined up. "They were trying to take the box apart carefully. It must have slipped."
"But what's the point?" said Carrot. "It's just a replica, sir. Even if you could find a buyer, it's not worth more than a few dollars."
"If it's a good one, you could swap it with the real thing," said Vimes.
"Well, yes, I suppose you could try," said Carrot. "There would be a bit of a problem, though."
"What is it?"
"Dwarfs aren't stupid, sir. The replica has got a big cross carved into the underside, and it's only made of plaster in any case."
"Oh."
"But it was a good idea, sir," Carrot said encouragingly. "You weren't to know."
"I wonder if the thieves knew."
"Even if they didn't, they wouldn't have hope of getting away with it, sir."
"The real scone is very well guarded," said Cheery. "It's very rare that most dwarfs get a chance to see it."
"And other people would notice if you had a great lump of rock up your jumper," said Vimes, more or less to himself. "So this was a stupid crime, but it doesn't feel stupid. I mean, why go to all this trouble? The lock on that door is a joke. You could kick it right out of the woodwork. If I was going to pinch this thing, I could be in here and out again before the glasses stopped tinkling. What would be the point of being quiet at this time of night?" The dwarf had been rummaging under a nearby display cabinet. She drew her hand out. Drying blood glistened on the blade of a screwdriver. "See," said Vimes, "something slipped and someone cut their hand. What's the point of all this, Carrot? Cat's piss and sulphur and screwdrivers. I hate it when you get too many clues. It makes it so damn hard to solve anything." He threw the screwdriver down. By sheer luck, it hit the floorboard's tip first and stood there shuddering. "I'm going home," he said. "We'll find out what this is all about when it starts to smell."